Gamar Joba, and welcome to The History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. I am your host, Roberto, and this is Myth 1, Jason and the Argonauts, Part 2 of 2. First off, please bear with me as I deal with microphone issues during this discussion, as well as general audio quality. Brendan came in sounding great, and he talks the most, so it won't be apparent until you hear me talk. I would like to make a few corrections before we officially start the discussion. We mentioned how the Golden Fleece came to Colchis during this interview, and we incorrectly say the name of Phrixus' twin sister. Her name is Hela, and the Hellespont is named after her. I then mentioned that the Georgian and Armenian alphabet may look similar. They do not. We then talk about Hyperion and Helios and what affinity they have been given. Hyperion and Helios occasionally share the affinity with the sun, but Hyperion is sometimes not given any affinity at all. Now, on to the discussion.
Hey everybody, my name is Brendan Foster. I am the editor of the show, and with Roberto's editing, that technically makes me co-writer.
Oh, gee, thanks.
Yeah. But anyway, I've known Roberto for, so I can say things like that to him. I've known Roberto for a very long time now. I think probably almost since sophomore year of college, which was like 2 or 3 years ago now.
2017, yeah.
Yeah, 2017. So it was 4 years ago. Yeah, it was four. Oh my god, it was 4 years ago.
Oh my gosh, I've been graduated 4 years now. 3 years.
Oh, that's right.
Okay.
Oh, god. Yeah, but anyway, yeah, so we met through D&D, and we just kind of kept in touch through all our adventures. And then he asked me to be editor of the show, and I gladly accepted because it sounded like a really cool project.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it so far. And
yeah,
and as you said, like with my writing skills, you're basically co-writer.
Yeah, no, you're fine, dude. You're fine. I mean, you. Like, you do that on, like, 2 hours of sleep anyway. One last thing. I have to promote myself. I recently was published in Real Clear Politics. If you just Google Real Clear Politics Brendan Foster, that's BrendanFoster, you can probably find it. But if not, I'm sure Roberto will leave a link to the article in the show notes or the description of the YouTube channel or something, of the YouTube video or something.
Yep, everything will be on the show.
Yeah. So anyway, that particular article I worked on for about 6 months or so, and it was about the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on the opioid epidemic in my beautiful home state of Pennsylvania. And it also gets into some other things like the challenges of running a harm reduction clinic in the midst of a pandemic and so on and so forth. So if that subject is important to you, and I hope it is, then you can go ahead and check that out.
I'll let you guys know that I did read it once he told me it was published, and it was super interesting read because we both studied up in Pennsylvania. So if you guys don't already know, I am down in Texas.
Yeah, no, Roberto was from Houston, but we met at Juniata College, which is a small private school in Podunk, Pennsylvania.
Arkentucky or Pennsyltucky?
Pennsyltucky.
There we go.
Yeah, that's so
right. Sorry, Pennsylvanians. You know, we know you love us.
No.
By the way,
no,
Sheets is
I'm
the best.
Pennsylvanian, and I get to criticize it.
Okay, so yeah, Jason and the Argonauts. So right, I was reading it, and as I was going through it, you know, trying to look for things that kind of involve Colchis. Honestly, like, you get, like, the end of book two, and then most of book three and a bit of book four. It's like they're in Colchis, but it's like, here's everything Jason's doing. Here's what Medea's doing. But then there's like absolutely nothing else after that. And it's like, so they just kind of tell us like, oh, here's a graveyard. And one thing I was reading is like that graveyard could also have been like Colchian burial practices during the time. And I'm like, oh, that's actually kind of interesting. So like they buried the men, like they hung the men up to like to dry basically, while the women were buried kind of like under the earth. Like for me, that was like some sort of balance. So, but what were your thoughts so far?
Yeah, my thoughts mainly were, well, first off, Greek mythology of any kind and mythology of any kind has been a passion of mine for a long time. I'm really interested in ancient cultures and ancient religions. Just what we've learned over what I've learned from just reading the scripts and listening to the show over the past few weeks is that the Greek sources on Georgia, which is all we have up to a certain period of time until the Roman sources, and then after that, I don't know, medieval sources, I guess. I don't do
The
the research.
Chronicles.
The Chronicles, which themselves are probably not written until hundreds of years after the events they purport to describe, right?
800s to the 1100s, depending on the chronicle. But like the one I have, the Georgian Chronicles, like I believe it's 1100, but that don't take that for fact. I haven't really gotten into it yet.
Right. So everything that we've learned about Georgia so far has been at a distance, geographically and temporally. There's only so much you can say about a cult, you can reconstruct about a culture from ancient sources, ancient literature. Because rest assured, there is no evidence that a giant fire-breathing snake guarded a golden fleece. In 2,000 or so years ago, I don't know how long ago this is supposed to.
Bronze Age, so basically
Bronze Age.
between 1700 to 1100 BC. But which is like the so like a small fact there is essentially like we don't see any like Greek evidence up until like the 6th century BC. So like the fact that they were like all the way like they Apollonius of Rhodes and all the Greeks before him who wrote about Jason or talked or told stories about Jason are like, oh yeah, Colchis. But like there's no evidence of Greeks up until the 600 like 6th century BC, and there's like no burial like evidence after like before the 8th century BC. So like that's kind of an interesting point for me. So it could be just like the loss of like just like territory or just stuff being burnt down or something or just repurposed. Who knows?
Records are just lost to time. In the further back you go, more of a problem this is. And when something is discovered, it's a really, really big deal. Like the Dead Sea Scrolls or what's it called? The Mithraic records? There's some a bunch of I think it was Gnostic Christian I just heard about this. Some Gnostic Christian records were found like in Egypt and it was written on papyrus, and papyrus is a tough material, but it certainly does not last forever in the wrong conditions. In dry conditions like Egypt, certainly that's what happened, but even then it's still rare. But anyway, the point is the Colchis that's described in Jason and the Argonauts, Apollonius of Rhodes was not the originator of the story, even though he was the earliest person to write it down. As we all know from anybody who studied Greek myths and legends, that things get distorted over time, like a game of telephone. Details especially tend to get distorted, although the structure of the story tends to get distorted. Some of the details is who were actually the crewmates of the Argonauts.
Yeah, like when I was reading it, like my copy of the book by Richard Hunter, I believe. I forget his name. I say it in
Richard
the show
Hunter.
earlier. Yeah, Richard Hunter. Basically he only mentions like Orpheus and Heracles as like Hercules for everybody who didn't get it. That
Heracles is the Greek name of Hercules, but most
yeah.
people know him as Hercules
Thank you,
because of the
Disney.
Disney movie.
Yep. Yeah, but basically they only mentioned them, and then like they mentioned like, oh yeah, here are the some other sons, because basically a bunch of the people, a bunch of the Argonauts are essentially like descended from the gods, or they're like demigods themselves.
Right, so Jason, I think, is
Grandson
Zeus's
of,
grandson. Yeah.
now, I don't think it's Zeus per se, but like it, as he's a
No,
grandson of somebody,
it was
huh?
Zeus. His grandfather's Hermes.
Yeah, Hermes. Yes, his grandfather's Hermes.
Right.
Yeah.
And Orpheus's mother was a muse.
Yeah. Got me some music, which makes sense.
Yeah, Theseus, who was sometimes a crewmate of the Argo, is the son of Zeus. Heracles, as many people know, is the son of Zeus. The Castor and Pollux, I think their name was. No.
Pollux, the Dioscuri,
Yeah,
Castor, and
Dioscuria, sorry. But sorry, Zetes, and I forget their other names are
Caetes, yeah.
yeah, the Caetes, they're sons of
The Boreas.
Boreas, who is
Yeah.
the northern wind, and he's like a very he's like one-eyed, serpent-tailed, very bizarre biology, and so is and it, his sons have are said to have wings either on their backs or their feet, or sometimes their silvery hair is so beautiful and light that they can fly with it. Like I said, it all depends on the source. But again, I think we've gone on enough of a tangent. You know,
We love tangents on the show,
we
though.
love sure
You
love
know
tangents
that.
on the show. But I guess the angle I wanted to tackle this with was the angle of exoticization. So Colchis, as we've learned over the past few months in the show, because of a combination of very sparse records, I don't believe, well, they certainly were not writing things down by the time the Greeks were writing things down. One thing you have to know about Greek sources is that the Greeks very much look down on everyone who is not Greek. This is human nature. You're going to find this all over the ancient world and ancient sources. I mean, we can't say it's difficult to say what we know about Gnostic Christianity, for example, because most of what we know is from early church fathers engaging in polemics against Gnostic Christianity. So we don't know what they believed or what is a complete distortion for the sake of propaganda, basically, but it's all we have. But if you want to know what the Greeks were like, the term barbarian comes from the Greek, and it was because the Greeks referred to anybody who was not Greek as a barbarian, because when they speak, because they don't speak Greek, they sound like they're saying bar, 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 bar. Hence, barbarian.
Yeah, makes sense.
Fun etymological fact for you.
So actually, on the point of the Greek being the thing, seeing people as, who don't speak Greek as barbarians. So when Jason and Medea first meet, we see that Jason after Medea gives Jason the drug, we see that Jason just kind of goes up to Medea's like, "Oh yeah, you should just come back to Greece with me if you think you're going to get in trouble." And it's like, and Medea is basically like, "I need to think about this because, you know." And Jason gives no thought to the fact that, you know, she's lived here forever, but Greece is awesome. So you just come back to Greece with me, and you'll be famous in Greece for helping me get the Golden Fleece. And for me, that's kind of like, oh yeah, the whole barbarism thing is like, yeah, you know, things are great in Greece, so you just come back with me in Greece, even though I've only been here for like one night and I know nothing about your country.
Yeah, I mean, the impression I got was that he has absolutely no consideration for what the Golden Fleece means. So, like, I believe it's a symbol of power and authority of King Aeetes.
Yeah, and it
Of
brings
course,
peace as well. Yeah.
yeah, and it brings peace to land of Colchis. So, of course, a Greek would say, "Oh, King Aeetes is just evil because he doesn't want to give up the Golden Fleece."
Yeah, and you see that when like they come back with his, you know, his grandsons who are like, "Oh yeah, they're the sons of a Greek guy who's an exiled hero." And like, "Oh yeah, they came back with a bunch of Greek soldiers." Like what else is he gonna think? That he even mentions like, you know, these are pirates that are trying to take my title and lands. When you have four men who have rights to his land just pop in, and it's like, no, you know, there's the true-born son Apsyrtus here, right here, and you know, these people are trying to steal everything from me.
Oh, I should also briefly mention in the story, the way the Golden Fleece got to Colchis was that I think it was a form of, it's either a form of Poseidon or the son of Poseidon. or a creation of Poseidon
Mm-hmm.
that rescued some twins. I think it was Io and Phrixus, or
Yeah,
Phrixus and
for sure.
His sister. And Phrixus
Yeah.
is the father, I think, right?
Yeah, of Argos and his other three brothers, yeah.
But anyway, so the Golden Fleece was an actual winged golden ram that Phrixus rode on while fleeing from I think his in because this is a Greek legend, it was from his homicidal parents or something.
More than likely.
Yeah. I'll have to look that one up because I forget, but so yeah, it's an artifact of immense power. And Jason feels entitled to it.
Yeah, because basically his uncle was like, yeah, go get this, suicide mission, you're never gonna succeed. And he's like, oh yeah, I need to go get it because the gods will it because they've been helping me out the whole time.
Right.
And
And
you see
granted,
the superiority of the Greek gods as well.
yeah. And granted, Hera was, it was her will. It was positively her will.
Yeah, for sure. She was mad at Peleus or Pelias, whatever. How are you? I see it different ways in the show.
Yeah, and that's another thing that shows up across Greek mythology is that, and you mentioned this at the start, the drama of history is oftentimes portrayed out as something that happens either for the gods' amusement or because they're too petty to give up conflicts and they don't really care about human beings, or they care about them in the same way they care about pets or like your favorite MMA fighter. You don't really care how hurt they get, you just want to see them succeed. And if they don't succeed, then you're just kind of bummed, and that's the extent of it.
Yeah. So yeah, it brought us on another tangent. You were mentioning that they were saying, oh yeah, Barbaros, barb, 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 barb. But yeah, let's just get back on track on that with that at least.
Yeah, well, I wanted to what I was where I was going for that going with that was so you can see in the sources I remember you said one source Greek doctors advised people not to go to Colchis because the swamps were filled with diseases, and the only reason the Georgians could withstand those diseases was because they were stout and swarthy, which is the fancy way of saying dark-skinned.
Yeah. And you can even see, because sometimes I've been to Russia a few times, as you know, and sometimes I get confused with the Georgian just because of my skin tone if they don't get me for Cuban immediately. Yeah. And so basically it's the whole thing where just because they're dark and swarthy, they're better attuned to the climate. But at the same time, still, they're still humans. They're going to get all the diseases someone normally gets from there. They're just better attuned, just better immune to it or something. They have more resilience to it. Yeah.
And this is the sort of, and also it's portrayed as a land of sorcerers and magic. They say people, they cannibalize people and they flay them alive in order to execute them.
Yeah. Actually, I was reading an article about the cannibalization thing, and it could just be people just interpreting the burial practices.
Right, I think you did mention that. I read that as
I
well.
didn't mention it. You sent me the article, so
I sent you that article. So this is not only the problem with some like people with taking Greeks at their word when they describe foreigners, like the Trojans or Libyans or whatever. Or church fathers, what they say about Gnostic Christianity can't really be trusted. And it sort of reminded me if the term is exoticization, which is you exoticize the other. And this term, I was thinking about this term because one of the podcasts I listened to, Weird Studies, shout out to JF Martel and Phil Ford. They did a episode on a genre of music called exotica, which admittedly problematically, it utilizes exoticization, but a pop culture reference people might understand is the second Indiana Jones movie, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, which is where, if you don't know it, are you messing with the backgrounds?
Sorry, it wasn't
Yeah.
blurred.
So if you've never seen the movie, Indiana Jones is like an archaeologist character. He's really a grave robber.
Aren't they all?
Yeah. So he follows in the proud British tradition of calling grave robbing archaeology.
Of course.
But so anyway, he travels to he inadvertently travels to India and he finds this village where magic rocks have been stolen, so nothing grows anymore and all the children have disappeared. And so he investigates and he comes across a palace, and at the palace they do crazy thing like eat sautéed monkey brains for dinner.
Chill the monkey brains.
Chilled monkey brains. And they get to talking about I think I guess an ancient sect or tribe called, or cult. I think it would call it a cult. It was a religious cult called the Thuggee, which in the story worshipped the Hindu god of destruction, Shiva. And this is called, Shiva is called the destroyer, and Shiva is the force of death and destruction, which must inevitably follow from forces of creation, and et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know how much of that is true, but what I do know is definitely not true is in the movie, they sacrifice people by ripping their hearts out in a magic ritual.
Kalima,
Kali Ma.
Kalima.
Yeah, and they have what I think is what is a British actor, played, Mola Ram was his name. So he rips people's hearts out, and then they're still alive because magic, and then they dip them into lava, which also again. Lava is so hot that your body would evaporate long before you even touched it. So that part of the movie is also inaccurate. But anyway, the point is, obviously none of that's true. It's a Hollywood movie. And also, you know that that movie was definitely not made by an Indian because the British are the heroes in that movie. Do
How
you
dare they
remember?
be the heroes? Yep.
Do you remember that? Of all
Yep, I
people,
remember that, yeah.
The British are the heroes of that movie. So an Indian didn't direct it or write it,
Or was even involved in a process.
or is even involved in the process. Well, there are Indian actors, but I doubt they had much
Yeah,
of a
like
placement.
in the writing process or like, with best practices. Essentially, like they didn't care much about, what was if they were culturally appropriating something or they were accurate to what was being portrayed on TV or the big screen.
The
Yeah.
point is,
So
they didn't care.
exoticization, yeah.
Yeah, exotization. They didn't care, and their audience didn't care. Their audience is ignorant of what things are really like. So, I don't know how many Americans, when they saw that movie, came away thinking that there was actually a cult called the Thuggee that performed human sacrifice.
Probably quite a few. It's
Yeah.
America.
Yeah. Prob But the point is, this is exactly what the Greeks did to the Colchians in Jason, Story of Jason and the Argonauts. Medea, as we know, is a witch. She's a sorceress, and moreover, she's not a nice person. Her name literally means schemer, and George and Colchians are always scheming. They're always scheming in Jason and the
Is
Argonauts,
it
even
so?
though
Isn't that
Jason
like,
is the king schemer.
yeah, Jason's a king schemer, and like, because like you can see multiple times, it's like, oh yeah, we're gonna try to persuade him to give us the fleece, and if he doesn't do it, we're just gonna take it by force, and like, there's even a part where like I got really aggravated was like,
Because you hate Jason.
I hate Jason. Like, I absolutely do not like that. Like, he doesn't do anything. Everyone else has to do things for him. And, like he doesn't do anything on his own volition. Everyone else is kind of like, oh, yeah, Jason, you know, this and that. Like, he didn't take up charge when, you know, he's like, oh, yeah, crew's going to vote for who's the leader. It's like, instead, like, no, I'm the leader. I brought us all together. He's like, no, let Heracles decide. And it's like, oh, like, you know, when they were on the island of the Lemnian women on Lemnos, they're like, oh, yeah, I'm going to stay, you know, just, you know, be with the queen for a while. And then and it was up to Heracles again, the hero that he is, who also has some bad things with him. I'm not going to get into that.
Heracles, once again, consistently being the only good and noble character in, well, I don't know. Greek heroes are very amoral. There are, like, a couple Greek taboos that come up again and again in across Greek mythology. One of them is patricide and fratricide, or killing one's own family. That's a taboo that will get you a hot date with the Furies, which are basically demons of torture and punishment that will chase you to the ends of the earth until you die if you commit any of these cardinal sins. So that's one of them. And the other,
unless you dismember them, and then they're just fine with you, completely fine with you, you know, like they did to Medea's brother.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Greek. Greeks also took magic seriously. But anyway, what was I saying? Oh, right. So the other Greek cardinal sin that you see pop up in, and especially in the Odyssey, for example, is hubris, pride. There are many, many characters in Greek mythology whose only sin was being better at something than the gods.
Phineas, for example, and
Phineas, for example, Prometheus, of course, who shows up in the story.
Yeah, literally.
All he did was cross the gods in order to help humanity, because Prometheus created humanity from clay in Greek religion. And the thanks he got from practitioners of Greek religion was the guy who was tortured every day until he was rescued by Heracles, because once again, Heracles is
the bomb, apparently, but he did some horrible stuff as well.
Well, he's done some horrible stuff, but like I said, Greek heroes overall are quite amoral by modern standards.
I would like to add that Hera made Heracles do a lot of stuff too. She just made him go mad. So.
Not the best person either. Overall, Heracles is like, he's the prototypical Superman. He's for the most part morally incorruptible. If he does do something, he didn't really mean it.
It was just probably Hera messing with him.
Yeah. And also, by the way, all Medea had to do in order to absolve herself of fratricide and infanticide was to just dismember her victim and also ritually purify herself, or have Circe ritually purify herself. Well, Heracles had to complete 12 labors, two of which were not part of the original deal.
Weren't the labors given to him as, like, cousin or something?
Yeah,
or
his cousin.
Brother?
He was the king of Thrace, I think.
Something like that. Somewhere around there.
Who knows?
We're here about Georgia.
Passion, but it's not my expertise. But again, Heracles' cousin, or uncle, I forget.
I think it was his cousin.
It doesn't really matter because Greek sources can't agree among themselves anyway.
Yeah, the history of ancient Greece podcast, they said cousin because, like, they were born around the same time, and, like, I think the god Hera made Heracles' birth last longer, so he wouldn't be first in line to inherit.
Right.
Yeah, so I think it was his cousin, just to make it easier.
Right. But anyway, so the other Greek fatal flaw that many heroes tend to have is hubris. Jason is certainly guilty of this. Odysseus is certainly guilty of this. I believe Theseus ends up being guilty of it as well.
They all do. Yeah.
Yeah. Most of them do. It's probably the most popular one. It's also, I guess it is Hercules' one, but arguably he has a very good reason to be prideful. If we define hubris as pride without a good reason, then Heracles for in many ways is not hubristic.
Yeah, he has good reasons. Look at everything he's done. Just because the gods want to mess with him. But he did become a god afterwards, and he's like revered by Rome.
He did eventually become a god, yes.
And he's revered by Rome. So like, you know, in half naked guy wearing a lion skin, no biggie.
Mm-hmm. No. Oh, you know, strong enough that he doesn't even need a sword. He just has a club. No biggie.
Yeah, right.
So yeah, overall, I think I said my point on that. The exoticization of Colchis, well, it has a tendency to reflect what the history of Colchis and Georgia was, which was that it was a people that was colonized and conquered, then the conquerors left, but then they got conquered again, and then some traders came and just said, this is mine now, and then they got reconquered.
Rinse,
and then they got
repeat.
Conquered again. And then they got conquered again. And then those people left. And I mean, it's constantly ongoing.
Even now, they're still occupied. So.
Even today, parts of Georgia, which is recognized by most of the, of course, it's recognized by Georgians, but it's recognized also by most of the international community as rightful Georgian land, is currently being occupied by Russia because it was historically a part of the Soviet Union. And I can't speak to the geopolitics of it. It's not my expertise.
I don't want to get into it now. We'll have stuff about that way later.
Yeah, we'll probably have stuff about that way later. And we've said this throughout. It's all, Georgia. Georgians have also very proudly maintained their language. They have
alphabet.
Yeah, they have an alphabet that is like no other, unless it is. And you were going to correct me on this just now.
The alphabet's kind of based off of the region. Because the Armenian and Georgian alphabet, I'm not gonna say who made it first because I'm not an etymologist, but they're very similar. I can tell you right now, I'm learning the Georgian alphabet, and it is killer.
Yeah,
but there's no uppercase or lowercase, so it works out.
It looks really cool.
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful language. Beautiful written language. I haven't heard much of it spoken. But I'm sure.
Only is Gamarjoba.
Yeah, Gamarjoba.
Yeah.
So, sorry to any Georgians hearing me pronounce that.
They got the warning in the introduction.
Yeah.
Episode zero.
Mm-hmm. And I guess as long as we're talking about people who are ignorant about Georgia talking about it, I only know what Roberto knows. And we're doing this as a passion project, looking from the outside in. So, Georgians, please don't get mad at us. We're trying our best.
Yes, please don't. I'm actually really into your country and have it tattooed on my arm somewhere. Yeah. So cut us a break.
Yeah. But anyway, like I said, it's a people that maintained a distinct culture, maintained a distinct language, a distinct alphabet. In between being off the top of my head, it's colonized by Greeks. Conquered by Alexander the Great.
Conquered by the Persians.
Conquered by the Achaemenid Empire of Persia.
Armenia.
What else? Oh, it was conquered by Armenia? Okay.
Yep. Conquered by Armenia. Then they had their own independent area for a while.
Yeah.
Then battled over by Rome and the Parthians. Mm-hmm. Romans, the Byzantines and Sassanids, Byzantines and the various Muslim successor states.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Alone for themselves for another while. They had the Golden Age. Then trying to repel off invading Muslim forces from the Islamic nations. Then annexed by Russia unwillingly. Then got themselves free. Then they got themselves conquered by their own son, who was in charge of Russia.
Yeah. What's that video, The History of Japan, by that? What's his face?
Yeah. I heard of it.
Yeah. And there's a scene, there's a part from that was like, knock, knock, it's the United States. But in this case, it's knock, knock, it's the USSR.
Yeah, I think he's Stalin, or was it Lenin? Probably Lenin. Probably both.
Yeah, I don't know.
I should know this. I technically do know this, but I'm not there yet, and I'm still trying to remember. I'm still reading about the Alexander successor states right now,
right.
And Medea. So
yeah, we could be here all, like, I mean, we have an entire podcast that's talking about all the times that Georgia was conquered or colonized. Or
the reason why the book is called The Edge of Empires, because it's always another empire coming in.
Right. It's a border state. It's on the border between Europe and Asia, for one. And depending on the political situation, everybody says it's European, or depending on the political or social, cultural, geographic situation, everybody says it's Asian, but it's always been kind of both.
Oh, so that actually reminds me of a point you were making earlier with the scheming Colchians. So one thing I was kind of reminded me of that. Technically, wouldn't that just show how far back, like, it goes in history that the West thinks of, like, everybody in the East as being, like, kind of scheming all the time?
I guess. I can't say I'm aware of that stereotype, but so it is a stereotype.
There's a stereotype where, like, people think that the people in the East are always scheming and, like, trying to, like, they're always scheming and planning something in the background. Because it was basically, like, a lot of, like, with the Persians, big thing with the Persians, and, like, they always thought the Persians were scheming something. It's because of, like, all the politics and all the backdoor stuff and all the stabby stab and all the fratricide going on. Like, right. I've even heard of it, like, up until modern day, where, like, people still think, you know, oh, yeah, you know, those Easterners, stereotypically, I'm not trying to be offensive, but the Easterners are always scheming something, you know, they're being sly. And even now, like, even, like, Eastern Europe, you can still see that with, like, oh, yeah, you know, even if the word, like, you know, Byzantine politics, it's always, like, backdoor, like, scheming type thing. So it's, like, a prevalent thought in Western Europe now, at least, like, stereotypically.
Yeah.
I might be wrong. Please don't. I mean, you can't quote me on that.
And yeah. I'm not trying to make out Georgians as perpetual victims because, well, historically speaking, this is what happens. Not being perpetual victims, but getting conquered a lot. For their very admittedly very attractive natural resources. And
have you had their wine?
Yeah, and their wine. I mean, who wouldn't want that wine?
I know. I mean, I have to make it a point of it almost every show.
Right, yeah. Because we need sponsorships. And I mean, if a Georgian travel company sponsors this podcast, or a Georgian wine company sponsors this podcast, forget it.
Yeah, right. I would never come back out of that bottle, just to be completely honest with you.
What bottle? Wanting the sponsorship?
Oh no, the wine.
Oh, the wine. Yeah, no. I still haven't had any. There's a Russian grocery store 20 minutes from me.
Oh yeah, you probably have some there. I recommend the semi-sweet red wine. That's my favorite. Okay. Georgians who are listening to this, sorry for the preference, but Alazani Valley, perfect.
Oh, I'm sure wine is going to be very controversial. If we ever have a conversation about it. In fact, I predict, it doesn't matter if we talk about religion or politics, I'm calling it now, we're going to get the most death threats over a conversation about wine.
Honestly, like, I was actually planning to come up for the, like, sometime in winter, like, at least, like, the Jersey area, but since you're, like, in PA, like, Eastern PA, like, I was just planning on going up there.
And
just
Trenton or Baltimore, dude.
Yeah, like, I'm, like, Jersey City, if anything, but, like, dude, like wine, Georgian wine tasting. There's a go to Brighton Beach. There's a few places there. Get a few wine glasses lined up. Make an episode about the Georgian wine tasting.
I would love to do an episode about that. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm not a wine. I'm not a wine guy. I'm not even much of a big drinker. But
neither am I. But you know, we'll get one of the Georgians in Brighton Beach to help us somehow.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure you probably have, knowing you, you probably have some random scatter all over the country.
Yeah, all over the countries.
All over the country. Yeah, all over the countries. Shoot, what was I saying? Oh, yeah, yeah. So, Georgia, I'm not trying to make out Georgia as a perpetual victim of much more powerful people here. If anything, I want to make them out as a resilient culture. It's a people who have probably resisted cultural erasure and assimilation since time immemorial.
Oh, for sure. And like, as I mentioned, like way back in episode one, it's the geography that helped, because if you couldn't find them in the pockets of where they were, like you couldn't find them at all. Like, it's one of the reasons why like a lot of people had such trouble conquering them, and they just kind of went with like the valley regions, because like, yeah, you could conquer like the central part, but like you couldn't conquer everything. And even then, they'd still find a way to kind of kind of get away from that. And for one, the Achaemenids weren't really a colonizing nation. So like, you know, they wouldn't go in and colonize. And with the Seleucids, which we're gonna Seleucids, whatever you want to call them, that was kind of like the far reaches of the empire as well. It's like northern border, so like it wasn't even fully conquered. I mean, I'm going with what I know off the top of my head right now, but honestly, like, they were always on the fringe of the empire. So like, it was just kind of like, well, there's mountains, so like we can kind of start going further in, but like there's a point where we kind of have to stop as well.
Yeah. And so I guess my point isn't that the Georgian culture or the Kartveli culture were or the land was, you know, perpetually occupied. It's more like, because it's so hard to conquer and so hard to keep a hold of while it's conquered, you know it's a people who have successfully fought off time and again, or managed to survive, as it is a distinct cultural identity throughout the years, in spite of the fact that their land was a constant source of conflict.
I know that, and that's for sure. Like,
we don't hear about the other cultures that got conquered and culturally erased, because
they're gone. If we do hear about them, it's because someone else wrote about them.
Yeah, if you did, someone else wrote about them, and it's probably really vague, probably inaccurate, but nobody knows if it's inaccurate or not, because it's literally all we have.
I mean, an example of that would be like the actual Prussians, the one that the Teutonic Order basically genocided away. Because like the Prussians we know of today, you know, with like Otto von Bismarck and everything, they're not the real Prussians. Like, they're not even actually Prussian, they're just German.
Right.
Like the real Prussians have been gone since like for a long time. And like, you know, the Germans kind of destroyed them, for being honest here. Well, at least the Teutonic Knights did, for being more accurate. The Teutonic Knights destroyed them because they didn't want them intermingling or anything. But right. The Teutonic Knights, that's not even related to the show, but I have words about them as well. Yeah. I read a lot of Polish literature too, so that's not helping at all.
Yeah. I mean, the term genocide was not even coined until after the Holocaust in order to describe the Holocaust. So, I mean, again, the ancient world was a brutal place. Us modern folk look back and we see exoticization and genocide. These were all normal things.
Yeah, just who's the conqueror of the week, basically.
Mm-hmm. We're horrified by them now, but it was, again, it was a common occurrence because of the nature of the ancient world, or not so ancient world, if we're being honest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I guess if we want to move on, the another article that I wrote was written for Archaeology Magazine, I think 2014. This is the one I sent to you, and this is where I got information about how it was widely believed that Colchian women were witches. You know, the monsters lived in the rivers mm-hmm. and would eat people. I'm sure that those figured frequently in the story of Jason and the Argonauts.
Not so much about the monsters in the river, but like mm-hmm. monsters, just like witches. Yeah. It was just Medea, really.
Yeah. Well, accusations of cannibalism, accusations of torturing mm-hmm. people by flaying them alive. The practice of air burial or sky burial, which to people who are used to burying their dead is a horrifying sight.
Oh yeah, for sure. Imagine like is walking in somewhere like, and you see dead bodies everywhere. Yeah, it's like, what are they doing?
They're hanging from the trees, and you assume, oh, all these people were murdered. I'm about to die, because it's terrifying. Like the smell of rotting corpses is there. You understand, exoticization, it comes from a place of xenophobia, but when cultures that are very different meet,
massive amount of cultural shock to begin with.
Yeah, when people of very different cultures meet, it can be horrifying. One of my, and for one, for another, it helps you think, you know, this is why, probably by why both Roberto and I travel so much, is because when you go to a country, you see something, you're like, why don't we do it like that? We're so backwards. Why don't we do it like that?
And then they're thinking the exact same thing about our country. I mean, maybe not so much about the U.S. right now, but like...
Mm-hmm. Like, you see some things you think like, oh my God, that's horrifying. And you see other things like, wow, I wish we thought of that. That's a great idea.
Yeah. It's actually one of the nice things I like about China is like, you could just... super cheap taxi services, like you could pay off your phone, like basically everybody took money off, like you could pay other people and businesses through your phone. It wasn't like such a big deal. You had like the one app to do it all on. It's not like, you know, we have to use Venmo for this, Samsung Pay for that, Apple Pay for that. It's like, no, it's just the one app everyone can use, basically.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, I think the vast majority of Bitcoining operations in the world are in China. Because electricity is really, really cheap.
And yeah, I remember
that. If you were to have a Bitcoin mining rig here in the United States, you would just not, you just wouldn't break even.
Yeah.
Or not any, just Bitcoin, just any cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it comes from a place of obvious xenophobia and bigotry when Apollonius of Rhodes and other Greek sources describe Georgia as being a land of scheming witches and sorcerers, and so on and so forth. It also comes from a place of cultural difference. I mean, right these days we have the privilege of hopping onto a plane and going anywhere we want in the world, and this is a consequence of globalization, but
yeah, you know, Jason and the Argonauts, they literally spent days and days going from Thessaly, which is like right above Athens, all the way to Georgia, which mm-hmm. right now would only take a few hours by plane.
Yeah, that's like a couple hour plane ride, and you can watch John Wick on the plane if you want.
I totally would.
Yeah, no, dude, I watched, when I was coming back from the Gambia, I watched the third...
Parabellum?
Well, did the third and fourth movie come out, or was it just
the third movie's already out? The fourth one is
coming.
Same time, yeah. Number four.
Yeah, no, I watched the second and the third movies on the plane just because I couldn't sleep at all. I don't sleep on planes; they're too uncomfortable.
Yeah, same.
But yeah, we have the privilege nowadays of cultural exchange telling us that genocide and xenophobia is messed up.
Yeah.
Even if Jason is what, selfish, petty, hubristic.
Yeah, like
ignorant.
He is everything like that, and I don't know. Like part of me, like Jason Isley's goes, like doesn't even talk to, you know, 80s himself at first. He gets his grandsons to do it, and 80s like, well, 80s eggs out his own grandsons, and you get them to talk to him first.
Right, right.
So it's like, you know, you could have talked to him first, but it's like, but it also shows, is like, you never see like them talking in a Colchian language. It's like, I don't mention it in the episode, but I do like, I remember reading it, where like the only time you see like Medea talking the Colchian language is when she goes to see Cersei.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh yeah, and they spoke to each other in the Colchian language, and I'm like, but it's just assumed that everyone just knows Greek at the same time, because it's like, well, that's the language the book's written in. And
yeah,
and then, you know, because Aedes is the son of Helios, it's like, of course he knows Greek. Mm-hmm. You know, Helios is a Greek god, the personification of the sun mm-hmm. himself, so of course they know Greek. And like,
yeah,
there's stuff in this palace that Hephaestus made, so yeah, of course they know Greek, no biggie.
Yeah. And I guess, isn't Hecate, I know Hecate is a Greek god. I don't know if there's any evidence she was worshipped in Georgia.
I don't recall any evidence of the, like, actual, like, the only Greek worship I know of is from the colonies. But, like,
right.
Like, as I mentioned, like, I think episode one is basically that for sure there's, like, a totemic thing where, like, you know, they looked at wolves positively. Which is,
yeah,
like,
yeah, like the wolf was sort of like Rabbit Boy in some indigenous American mythology, several indigenous American mythology. I think Cherokee in some plains.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a person. Is it a personified animal or is it just a wolf?
I think it's just a wolf, but it's where they got, like, because you have the king Vakhtang, and Vakhtang is a pretty common name in Georgia right now, which basically means wolf or like. And he had, like, Vakhtang the wolf-headed, and, like...
Right.
And, like, you know, he's basically personified by the wolf, but it technically still means wolf as well. So, basically, wolf the wolf-head.
Right, yeah, yeah. But, yeah, anyway, the wolf was, like a founder deity. Like, a lot of the Greek heroes that we encounter here are also founder heroes. Theseus mm-hmm. is the founder hero of Athens. Well, I think a lot of Greek settlements on Colchis are explained as sons are what are the servants of King Aetes that preferred not to go back to face King Aetes' wrath and just settled on.
Yeah, so like his sailors basically. Mm-hmm. Like, it was like, oh yeah, you know, we couldn't. Like the first one, like, you know, they both failed at capturing Medea, and they're like, oh yeah, so like we'll just stay here because who wants to go back to Colchis? Which also you kind of can see the Greek superiority thing there, because like they'd rather just stay where they are. Like, oh yeah, they're going to stay in Greece, like, of course. Yeah,
and like, then the why barbaric, not? Yeah, and then the barbaric, savage Colchians realized that Colchis sucks and Greece is awesome.
Yeah, it was just kind of implied there, and like. One thing, you also have to, like, remember that Apollonius of Rhodes was, like, writing during, like, the Diadochi period, too. So, like, Diadochi being, like, the post-Alexander period.
Right, so Alexander the Great had just made Macedonia proud.
Yeah, so he had his four successors, and that was the Diadochi. Because I'm just saying Diadochi because I don't remember all that. I technically do, but, like, they spread into four different empires, basically. And... And essentially, they were just all arguing all the time. They were known, the Wars of the Diadochi, which I think would be a great TV series, in my opinion.
I'd watch it. Sounds good. There was a Jason and the Argonauts TV series in 2000. Did you know that?
Yeah, I actually saw that, but I didn't. I was like, I don't want to watch a miniseries right now. And I only watched the movie, and I regret watching the movie, because, like, the movie... Like, you know, I love classic movies, but the movie sucked.
Yeah, I guess... I can forgive bad effects, and the acting was good, I guess.
Yeah, the acting was great. I just didn't like the fact that he just changed everything. And, like, this had, like, 2 seconds in Colchis.
Yeah, I mean, so if we're done talking smack about Jason a little bit, one thing I hated about the 1963 movie is how they removed Jason's agency fairly often.
Yeah.
They removed the agency of, well, for one, they removed the agency of mortals altogether. In the story, it is Phineas's wisdom, his ability to see into the future, his knowledge of the Clashing Rocks, and it's, what's his name? Typhus?
Typhus, the steersman, yeah.
Yeah, Typhistus, who was the pilot of the Argo. They were able to get through the Clashing Rocks because of those two things. It was human knowledge and human skill. And in the movie, oh, Triton just holds the rocks back to keep them from flat hitting them. And it's just because Hera wanted it to happen. There's no agency on the part of mortals whatsoever. I hated that.
Oh, yeah. And it was just like the whole thing where, like, Jason has to ask Hera, can only ask Hera for help five times because Zeus, mm-hmm. because that's what Zeus allowed her to do. But as you read the book, Hera just does what Hera wants to do. It's not even like, mm-hmm. oh yeah, Zeus told me I couldn't. She's like, nah, I'm just doing it.
Yeah, and they can, because what amounts to massive, life-changing, earth-shaking events on the mortal plane amounts to petty squabbling among the gods.
Yeah, they, they got that right.
Deal to them.
Yeah, they got that right, because
yeah.
I remember at the beginning of the movie, it was basically like, oh yeah, like, yeah, you know, she could, you know, Jason's, I think it was his mother or his sister, one of those, called out to Hera five times and before Pelias killed her. And then it was like, well, she called out for you five times. So you can only help Jason that many times.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, you also see this in the Aeneid is about the Trojan War, right?
The Aeneid? No.
Yeah.
That's the Iliad. The Iliad is about the Trojan War. The Aeneid is about the Roman right. one. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So the Iliad. I mean, the story goes that whole conflict started because Paris said that Aphrodite was pretty. And it even started before then because Ares wasn't invited to a party at the gods.
Ares or Eros?
Ares. Eris, the goddess of discord.
Oh, Eris. Okay, sorry. They all sound so similar.
Okay, sorry. I thought you knew this, but the story of the Iliad, the Trojan War.
I read it. I didn't read it well, though.
Oh, okay. Well, Eris, the goddess of discord, was not invited to a party or something. So, I don't know. Enchanted golden apples were involved somehow. I forget. Or golden apples of chaos, and. And then there was like a beauty contest between Athena, Aphrodite, and Hera, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I think Hera offered Paris long life or something. Athena offered him wisdom and success in battle, and Aphrodite promised him the most beautiful woman in the world, which was Helen of Troy. And then after that, the gods split into factions of whether they were supporting the Trojans. Who were attempting to get Helen back, and between the Greeks who were attempting to protect Paris and keep what they felt was his lawfully obtained bride.
Oh, but mind you, Helen was already married.
Yeah, Helen was already married. Wasn't she already married to Hector?
Yeah, Hector, yeah.
Right, you know, Hector... You know, Hector was a Trojan hero and enemy of Achilles.
Yeah, so, like, they were already married, and it was basically like, oh, yeah, you know, we'll give you the most beautiful woman who's Helen of Troy. Doesn't matter if she's married. You know, I'm the god. I can do whatever I want.
Yeah. Well, I don't think Paris was a god. I think he was a demigod.
You know, but I meant, like, with like, Aphrodite, and kind of like, yeah, I'll give you the most beautiful woman. And it was like, oh, yeah, sure, why not?
Yeah. And, well... She can do that. She has the power. She's a goddess.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's kind of like, what about, you know, what was Helen... Would Helen be fine with this? Come on.
Yeah, and I mean, this just ties into a lot of themes that you see throughout Greek mythology. If you've ever seen the movie Hereditary, they talk about this as well. Spoilers. The story of Oedipus Rex is all about how avoiding one's own fate only causes one to stumble right back into one's own fate. You can't win. Mm-hmm. And fate is something that I think governs the gods, but it's mortal fate is a plaything to the gods. And I think I'm guessing that this was a way of bringing explaining the complexities behind why social phenomena such as war happened, and also because these are just stories. You have to remember, this would have been told by a poet standing out in the street, retelling stories that have been passed down for generations. They were told for entertainment. They were told to explain things. They were told to give communities context in the grand unfolding of the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
To essentially make themselves feel like their existence and fate and actions were significant. Because everybody thinks of themselves as the protagonists of their own story.
Of course.
Yeah. Not all cultures, but certainly Greek culture, yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, everyone's a protagonist. Like, we're all the protagonists, which you can also see with Idas, the one drunk guy who was always accusing Jason of being a coward. He was like,
Idas.
The what?
Doesn't he die? I hope he dies.
No. Well, we don't. Well, technically, he would be dead by now. But it isn't. Nothing happens to him. It's actually the guy who's like the prophet who talks to him, or the seer dude. It was like, stop being such a vainglory. Edus? And it was like, and they started fighting.
Right.
Yeah, Edelman. Yeah.
That guy was cool. That's Ido. That guy was cool. I liked him.
Yeah, Edelman. Yeah.
Yeah, Edelman.
Edelman. Yeah. I liked him a lot. Especially when he was reading, like every time he came up was a treat.
Maybe Idman? Yeah. I don't know.
Idman. I'm just saying it with an accent. Maybe it'll sound Greek.
Yeah, maybe it's correct. But anyway, so Colchis. Again, back to exoticization. Colchis was thought of as a land of great riches, which it is, actually. And they mentioned in this article that I mentioned all the way back, where they recounted the author's interviews about the state of archaeology in Georgia and his travels through. I think he was in Tbilisi. I don't know if he was in Tbilisi.
He was in Vani.
Yeah, he was in Vani, right. Because he said he was on the border with Russia. Georgians are proud that they maintained their cultural identity, language, alphabet, so on and so forth, throughout all this time. And this gets into what one of the things that is pretty neat about the relationship of Jason and the Argonauts to Georgia, to Georgian culture is...
Mm-hmm.
When you read the story, and I read ahead to Euripides' Medea, I don't get the sense that Medea is a very admirable person.
But it could also be the Greeks just kind of writing her like that, too.
Yeah, it could be the Greeks writing her,
Because, like Jason's the one who's, like, basically screwing her over.
Yeah.
at all times.
Yeah, I mean, this was clearly a sexist poem, because they say... Jason was dishonored by having women help him. And, again, mentioned Helen of Troy was more or less the property of Paris. But Medea was also probably the one woman in the story who, she's not totally autonomous, because almost everything she does is
because of Hera.
Is because of Hera, and because Hera infected her mind with infatuation.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, she is very much a prototypical strong female character, even if she doesn't have much autonomy. I mean, I can certainly see why a modern author might want to rewrite her in a certain way as a strong female character, because she was clearly very powerful. She had depth to her, for sure.
Like, she has, like,
in a Greek story, in a Greek poem, she had quite a lot of depth to her.
Yeah, she actually had, like, thoughts she had. It wasn't like, oh, yeah, you know,
internal
Chakiopi, you know, she had an internal monologue with herself. Like, oh, Chakiopi did this, this queen did that. It's like, no, she actually thought about herself, or, you know, what people would think about her.
Yeah,
she helped Jason.
Yeah.
And, like, she was terrified of her father. Like, you could actually feel what she was thinking about when you read through. And, mm-hmm. like, for me, that was, like, for such old literature, like, that's something you don't see at all, usually.
Mm-hmm. Which, because they couldn't just do that, so they had to make up for it by having her being a scheming, fratricidal witch.
Yeah.
That worships a weird goddess of ambiguous intent towards mortals.
Yeah, she's like Hecate is like the goddess of like magic witchcraft, the night
magic
moon
witchcraft.
Basically, whatever Medea does is what Hecate is, you know, the goddess of. Basically, you would think of her as what a demon would be like nowadays.
Yeah, she's certainly portrayed as being just a dark goddess, a dark mother in the movie at the very least. I can only assume that's the role she plays in the story, as told by Apollonius of Rhodes, even if she was a Greek goddess that was worshipped by the Greeks.
Yeah, like, she doesn't really, like, have, like, too much of a, like, influence. And basically, the only real big influence, like, oh, yeah, they go to Hecate's temple, Medea's, you know, priestess of Hecate, and that was pretty much it.
Yeah. But, and you mean, in herself, Hecate, in addition to being a goddess of magic, she is in darkness. I believe she was the daughter of Nyx, Knight, or some other dark or evil primordial deity. Evil according to the Greeks, which is, like we've said, heroes themselves are quite immoral, and gods can be just or petty, depending on the story, mostly petty. But, you know, Hecate is a goddess who appears as a maiden, a mother, and a crone. You know, in addition to being female and a female goddess in a patriarchal society, she represented the stages of life, so she represents the passage of time. So in a way, she represents how human life itself is not, it's not a being, it's a becoming. In Heraclitus' terms, it's in constant flux. And she represents crossroads, so she represents a transitional phase. She represents a point where things are contradictory, because there are two roads which are separate beings that are joining, so there's an internal contradiction there. And she represents a time of choices where things are uncertain and scary. This, in anthropology, we call this a liminal period. And of course, adolescence is a liminal period biologically, emotionally, and socially and culturally. In the Western world today, the concept of the teenager wasn't really a thing in historical anywhere, let alone ancient history. So, you know, it's all about liminality, betweenness. Hecate is a liminal goddess, and Colchis is an edge. You know, and when you get to the edge, there are monsters and dark magic and dangerous and so on and so forth. You know, it's uncertainty. It's not home.
Mm-hmm.
It's
actually, that makes a lot more sense, actually. Yeah, I'm thinking about it.
One of my favorite books is The Philosophy of Horror by Noel Carroll. And he borrows an idea. I believe the anthropologist's name was Mary Douglas. And she actually wrote an essay about this, which is why I'm so, you know, I know I can say this. In anthropology, we call it liminality. He uses the term interstitiality, which he borrows from Mary Douglas.
For us laymen who don't understand that.
Sorry, what?
Interstitiality, yeah. What is...
So interstitiality is basically a fancy word of saying betweenness. So we have a bunch of cultural categorizations, right? So, and from a scientific standpoint, night and day is just it's just states of time as they pass. But throw out the literal material reality and think about human society and human culture. Night and day carries so many connotations with them. And one of the connotations is binaristic thinking or duality. So when you break that dualistic or binaristic thinking, such as twilight or dusk, things like new beginnings, we start talking about how human culture has interpreted the world around it. And you start encountering, for the most part, things which are scary, mysterious, dangerous, uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
And this carries over into the cultures which the anthropologist Mary Douglas studied. So she noticed that the indigenous tribe which she was studying was afraid of flying squirrels. Now, why would they be afraid of something like a flying squirrel? That's totally harmless animal. It's because a flying squirrel breaks the boundary between a flying animal and a land animal. You can't place it. We always say ambiguity is the root of fear. You can't place a creature like a flying squirrel. Some cultures might find that scary. And similarly, lobsters. Lobsters are kind of like an insect, but not really.
They're delicious, that's why.
Yeah, well, they're certainly delicious. But, you know, they're
bottom feeders, basically.
Yeah, they're bottom feeders, so they're disgusting in the first place. And they're just gross to look at. They're just gross and scary. I'm not speaking objectively here. You might find lobsters very beautiful. But anyway, and also lobsters are from the ocean, which is something which is massive, vast, dark, and unknown. And it has crazy things like sharks and giant squid and whales that are bigger than houses. It's no wonder so many people believe that there were sea serpents and sea monsters, because it's a huge unknown, and probably one of the best ways to get people to avoid danger is to convince them that something like a giant squid is out there waiting to eat them up, if they're not careful.
Actually, that gets me to thinking. As I was reading Jason and the Argonauts, the Argonautica, mm-hmm. I actually noticed that, like, there wasn't that many monsters per se. The only thing you really see are harpies, and you have this, an ever watchful serpent, and you have the earthborn men, and the two sets of earthborn men, but like you don't really see, like, those are all the monsters you see, because everyone else they fight are either people or they're birds.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's because that's monsters are something for the hero to overcome. Theseus slays the Minotaur, liberates his people, and goes on to found Athens. And Heracles faces a lot of monsters, to say the least.
Yeah, true.
Because they are impossible tasks.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a goal. It's something for the hero to overcome. It's not really about the goal in itself.
Yeah.
But to summarize how this connects to modern day human culture, Mary Douglas also noticed with this tribe she studied that items of great magical or ritualistic power were also interstitial. And so you see this today with how Noel Carroll applies this idea in an attempt to interpret monsters that we see in horror. So there's three kinds of interstitial beings, which are things which are in between two categories. There are things which are an incomplete version of a category, and there are things which simply have no category at all. They're perpetually above or outside the category. So in the first example, you have something like a werewolf or a ghost, which is both an animal and a man, or which is both living and dead. You also see this applied to, like, for example, Dracula in the story is sort of like a metaphor for weird foreigners coming in and infecting people.
I never thought about it that way.
Well, that's how it is in the story. That was certainly the intention of Bram Stoker. And then if you want an example of something which is incomplete, you think of a zombie. It's not only both living and dead, but it's rotting. It's incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, you have something like the Blob or the Thing from John Carpenter's The Thing. You can't place it because it's not really anything. It's just a thing. You can't say if it's a plant or an animal or a fungus or what, or even a living thing. Maybe it's just a non-sentient thing that just constantly hungers and consumes or assimilates. And you know, you can really go far to interpret a lot of things, both in human stories and human culture, human politics, of these categories that we set up, and why people are so afraid of certain things. Things which are, well, it's the fear of the unknown, I believe, when it comes down to it. And Noel Carroll also has in the book the example of the reason why there are things like haunted houses or graveyards or the vast unknown ocean. These are all spaces which are marginal to human society. As is Colchis. Colchis was marginal to Greek society. And you see this in things like fairy tales, like German fairy tales. It's always in the woods where there are talking owls that'll eat your face and witches and so on and so forth. Or it's always in modern Western movies. It's always in the great untamed West, where there are strange, wise Native American medicine man who can heal the hero and help him in his journey.
AKA Jonah Hex.
Yeah, AKA Jonah Hex. It was a common belief among the Puritans that first settled the continental United States that, like, the woods was where witches and their familiars lived. Which also kind of understandable because, I mean, they died of disease all the time. It was an unfamiliar territory. They faced constant Native American raids. These were, most of the time, we think these beliefs are silly now, but People just didn't come back from voyages out to the sea all the time.
Yeah, because you would have freak storms that would just cause the ship to go down, or
and then freak storms
stuff would happen to them. Yeah,
and they don't understand why, and they have a great need to understand why, because otherwise they're not in control of the world. If they can sacrifice something to Poseidon, well, at least they have some measure of control. Even in reality, there's absolutely nothing anybody can do. It's very difficult for human beings to accept that there's nothing they can do about a situation. And it's in those cases where they have a tendency to invent stories that have no backing to them whatsoever.
So, Brendan, I think we're going to stop with a... So it's getting quite long right now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I guess I just wanted to close out here. I wanted to talk a little bit more about Medea and what she means. So the Golden Fleece means quite a lot to Georgians. Is that correct?
Yes, that is very correct. Because even now, like, I think somewhere like on the Black Sea coast, probably in Batumi, like, it's one of the biggest, like, port cities. Basically, if you want to compare Batumi to a city in the U.S., Batumi would be your Miami.
Right.
Yeah, and they literally have a statue there of Medea holding up the Golden Fleece. I'll put us the picture of this on the website and social media. But yeah, there's a statue of Medea there holding the picture, holding up the Golden Fleece. There's literally, like, even in Georgia now, there's the Order of the Golden Fleece, which is one of the highest medals you can win in Georgia, or you can be awarded in Georgia. So like that's one of the things, like, oh yeah, you know, the top thing you can get here is the Order of the Golden Fleece as an award.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, it's not heavily prevalent, but it's still there. And like, they still use it in their own culture. And there's even the fact that like the city, Kutaisi in their like insignia / brand, like city, like flag or something, they have the Golden Fleece on there as well, because Kutaisi is what we would recognize now as Aya, and was, or as you know, as the capital of Colchis at the time. And so it's very prevalent there nowadays. We're just, you know, like, it's just kind of like hinted at, kind of like, you know, I wouldn't know how to exactly kind of put it in regards with the what the U.S. has, but like for them, it's like, it's not a big deal, but it's something that's a deal, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, I think that's one thing we found out is that, yeah, it's sort of a big deal, but...
it's kind of not at the same time.
It's kind of not, which is kind of inconvenient for us because we had to find something else to talk about. I think we did okay in the end.
Yeah, you know, an hour and a half.
Yeah, and I just, again, we'll be editing some stuff out, so it won't be an hour and a half.
Yeah, for sure.
Exactly, but what Medea herself means to Georgians today. It's a popular name for girls, even though, again, Medea is a scheming, fratricidal sorceress who practices black magic, according to the Greeks.
According to the Greeks, Georgians
have a very different view of her. I mean, in the article I read that was published in Archaeology Magazine, they ask an old woman for directions to Medea's home city. And they're like, do you know how to get to so-and-so? And they're like, you know, Medea's city. And their Georgian was very limited. So she was like, ah, Medea. You know, she immediately perked up and she was like, yeah, I know her. Yeah.
Yeah, so like, she's very prevalent. Like, people, like, you can go to like most Georgians to be like, oh yeah, do you know about Medea? They're like, how can we not know about Medea? This is our history.
Right,
and
right.
And you know, I even had a Georgian friend named Medea, and like that I studied along with when I was in Russia, and like she's awesome, and like so, yes, like it's a very predominant name. You know, they have a pretty good opinion of her, or I would say, you know, because it's like it belongs to them. That's why they have a good opinion. Kind of like,
she's probably one of the few Georgians in the story, or Colchians in the story, who have agency, depth, power, quite a lot of power. Even if her, again, the Greeks had to make up for such a positive portrayal by making her a scheming witch.
Which, yeah, exactly.
you know, again, her name literally means schemer. But again, you know, if this was a Colchian story or a Georgian story, they probably would have been very different. It would be a story about a guy named Jason who was bloodthirsty and evil, stealing
the golden fleece,
kidnapping his daughter, or turning his daughter against him.
Killing their son.
Yeah, killing their son.
Yeah.
With, with the help of a powerful
Greek pirate, yeah.
Foreign goddess.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I'm not at all surprised that people like the Georgians, who were in almost constant conflict over maintaining their land, their autonomy, their freedom, and their cultural identity, would identify with a character like Medea. I'm not at all surprised.
Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be surprised either, because it's the same as we mentioned, like, Medea belongs to the Georgians now. It's not like, you know, it's not like you go to Greece and it's like, oh yeah, you know who Medea is? Like, isn't that Jason's wife? Or
yeah.
Something like that? Or like,
yeah.
Or even like Achilles' wife? And like, because Medea, you know, after she goes away from, after she leaves Jason off hanging in the cold, she goes off and marries like a few other people. So it's not like, you know, she goes off and like, she's a powerful sorceress who could use that power to her advantage and marries other men at the same time. So it's not like she's like, it's not like she doesn't have free agency. Like, she shows up in other stories, just like even if vaguely, Medea still shows up in like other Greek stories, kind of having influence, you know, and like having kids with other famous Greeks as well.
Right. But I keep saying this again, because she has agency, they had to make her evil and practice black magic.
Yeah, for sure. And like, and you know, Hecate being her grandmother, I believe, or just her mother, or like probably her grandmother.
No. Her grandfather is Helios, and that's why she's so powerful. She's only a priestess of Hecate.
She's a priestess of Hecate, but Circe is her aunt.
Yeah, his aunt. And Circe also, you know, features in the Odyssey as somebody who is a powerful woman who victimizes men.
That's not that I'm getting my information wrong. It's the fact that, so basically Circe could also be Medea's sister, because because Circe was born of the union between Aedes and Hecate, but sometimes it's just Helios and Percy being, Medea's like grandparents. So like, it's one of those things.
Yeah,
like, you know, it's a Greek story. So like, they're not very, it's super complicated. So like, we don't know which one's which, but it just depends. Like, sometimes Medea is related to Hecate, sometimes she's not.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the thing with divine births. The way I thought about it is like, I think it's like, what are some divine, like Zeus impregnated Theseus's mother as a rain of golden flakes or something. And in this case, I think it's a case where either I think Circe or Medea's parents were her grandfather was Helios. Helios, the personification and Titan of the sun. Maybe that was Hyperion, I forget.
I'm pretty sure it's Helios.
Right, well, Helios is like the sun disk.
Oh, this is getting into all kinds of Greek madness. All right, anyways, related to Helios, yeah?
Yeah, Helios, and then maybe her mother was Hecate, but either way, you don't really need to know the explanation for it. All you need to know is that she was a woman who had agency, therefore she was a witch.
Yeah. So basically, Medea, Greeks to portray her as horrible because she was basically somewhat autonomous.
Because
she didn't listen to men, mostly.
Because she, you know, possessed power, whereas, you know, other people like, well, when Greeks trick people, like Heracles, for example, tricked Atlas into retrieving the golden apples while he held up the sky for him. That's Greek heroes being men, being clever tricksters. But when Medea does it, she's an evil scheming witch.
Yeah, exactly. And we don't, and to be honest, we also don't, we can, it's just conjecture at this point, if it was Medea who decided to kill her brother, or if it was just Jason who just decided to kill him instead. Because they could have just knocked him out and just left.
Yeah, I mean, they could have. But I think in the story, it was because it was to slow down King Aeetes, because they knew that if they dismembered Medea's brother, half-brother, that her father would stop to pick up the pieces. So,
yeah, I didn't see that in my copy of the book, but so that might be why. Just translations, because like that's the problem with like having various translations of stuff is like sometimes they add stuff and sometimes they take stuff away because they don't like it.
Yeah,
because I would have mentioned that in my book if I saw it in there.
And it doesn't really matter because in a lot of Greek mythology, things just sort of happen, and then they're attributed to magic or to the will of the gods.
Yeah, it's also true. Brendan.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Finish your thought first.
It's like, which, you know, doesn't make for good storytelling by our standards, but these stories have also survived for centuries for a reason.
Yes, Brendan, it's been a pleasure having you here. Thanks for talking.
Yeah, no problem. And I had a lot of fun talking.
Yeah, I did too. So hope to have you. Well, we're going to have you again here soon when we talk about Medea. Probably be a lot shorter than this one.
So, anyway, just to remind everybody, my name is Brendan Foster. I'm the editor of the show. De facto co-writer. De jure editor, de facto co-writer. And if you want to see my article in Real Clear Politics, you can Google Real Clear Politics Brendan Foster, spelled B-R-E-N-D-A-N. No other spelling is correct.
I'll put a link up on the page website as well. Under the episode show file.
All right, so
it's been a pleasure, and we'll see you again for the next episode.
Well, that was an enlightening discussion. I surely hope that everyone enjoyed it as much as I did. You can find Brendan on Twitter at Foster_writing, or if you want to ask him a question, feel free to drop us an email and I'll direct it to him. Thanks for sitting through this long discussion once more. It's our first time doing something like this, so now that we have more of a semblance of what we're doing, we have a way better idea of how to prepare for this next time. If you enjoyed the episode, please consider giving us an iTunes review, or even messaging me via email. I'd love to hear from you, and reviewing on iTunes will help our show grow more. If you do have anything you want to say, feel free to look us up on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram as The History of Sakartvelo, Georgia, on Twitter at History_Georgia, on our website at historyofsakartvelo.com, or on our email at thehistoryofsakartvelogeorgia@gmail.com. Sakartvelo is spelled SAQARTVELO. Madloba da nachfamdist. And thank you for listening to The History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. See you next time.